This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Anthony Brooks in Washington. Neil Conan is away this week. Many Americans like to think of the United States as a land of opportunity, a country where anyone can accrue wealth if they work hard enough, pass it on to their kids, who can then enjoy a better standard of living than they did. But a new study funded by the Pew Charitable Trust suggests that many more whites benefit from that promise of upward mobility than blacks. The study tracked more than 2,000 families for about three decades, and among the findings, nearly half of African Americans born to middle-income families plunged into poverty. What's going on here? Why the difference? And what can be done to help more African Americans share the dream of upward mobility? Give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org, and you can comment on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And joining us now is Julia Isaacs. She's the Child and Family Policy Fellow at the Brookings Institution here in Washington, and she's the author of the Economic Mobility Study funded by the Pew Trusts. Julia, welcome to the program.
It's good to be here.
It's good to have you. So flesh out, if you would, this key finding. What does the report say about the chances of upward mobility for blacks and whites?
Well, we found that overall, two out of three Americans have higher income than their parents, which is what you would expect in a growing economy, that each generation would do better than the one before it. Then we looked at it more closely by race. And let me focus on families in the very middle of the income distribution. Mm-hmm. We found that for white children in the middle, two out of three did better than their parents, just as we found for the society overall. However, for black children, only one out of three did better than their parents. In other words, a majority have lower family income than their parents. Mm.
And it's quite dramatic because that one out of three, they're born of middle-income parents, correct? And they pretty much drop into a sort of lower-income world.
Yes. So these are they were children in 1968. And back in 1968, their parents had income. Well, let me put it in 2006 dollars. They had incomes of about 43,000 to about median income of about $56,000. So these were not poor families, and you might expect that they would be passing along their economic advantages to their children. And some of them are, but a majority of them are not.
Mm. Now, another finding that was interesting, you found increased income for both black and white women, but it was particularly high for white women, and that accounted to the overall increase, correct?
Yeah, well, we were looking at the growth in family incomes that we'd seen over this period, and then looking more closely at men and women. And men's incomes, both white men and particularly black men, had flat or actually declining incomes. So what's driving the growth in family incomes for both groups is the strong growth in women's earnings as they're entering the labor force in increasing numbers. And as you were saying, the growth for white women is particularly strong. We compared women in 1974 and 2004. And back in 1974, non-Hispanic white women had a median income of only $4,000. And now, in 2004, it's risen to $22,000. So quite an increase. Hmm. For black women, the increase was from $12,000, so it was higher than white women back in 1974, to $21,000 now.
What does the report say about progress in reducing the gap in family income between blacks and whites? I mean, has there been any progress made in that?
Not really progress. As I've just said, the men's incomes have, we're looking at people in their 30s to kind of get a certain generation we're looking at, and men's incomes have been flat. Women's incomes have been rising. White women's incomes have been rising more than black women's incomes. So the net effect is that family incomes have been rising more for white families than black families. Mm.
Does the data, the study, which tracked data over 30 years, show any movement one way or another in the course of those three decades? In other words, was there a time during the period when income disparity seemed to lessen or increase, or did you not look at it that way?
In one place we did, yes. There have been some movements up and down with the economic cycle. We focus on 1974 and 2004 in this piece of the analysis. And in 2004, family income for African Americans was 58% that of white families.
Mm-hmm. And any ideas, does the report go into any of this as to why there has been such little progress toward closing this income gap between whites and blacks?
What we're doing in this report is sort of laying out basic statistics about mobility. We feel that the whole, as you said, the American dream is all about mobility, but yet we don't have a basic sense of how it's working. So this is more descriptive statistics, and we did not structure the report to go into underlying factors.
Mm. Do you have any theories, though, about that?
Well, we looked at some of the, we did do a literature review looking at the some of the differences. We're controlling for income, mm-hmm. but we're not controlling for other differences. So, for example, one researcher has looked at the large differences in wealth that even when you control for, you know, your annual income, there still are, between whites and blacks, there still are large differences in wealth, such as home ownership.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Julia Isaacs. She's author of Economic Mobility Studies for the Pew Foundation, and we're talking about the difference between black and white families and how the possibility of upward mobility is vastly different. You can give us a call at 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And let's take a call. Let's go to Jim, who's calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. Hi, Jim.
Thank you. Yes, I would like to ask your guest, although I don't disagree with the findings and they're tragic in nature, what about whites and blacks from rural societies? Because, you know, I come from a rural society, and I'm sorry, I have to totally disagree with her findings, because whites and blacks from rural societies suffer disproportionately and about on an equal plane with each other. When you're talking about Appalachia and places like that, I don't see how that study applies to those people. All you have to do is simply drive through where there's 70% unemployment, and I just don't see that upward mobility.
Hmm. Well, Jim, let me put that question to Julia. Julia, did your study take into account the kind of distinctions that Jim is talking about, that is rural white society versus the rest of the white society?
So our data set has about 2,000 families, which would not be enough to sort of split it out to that level of detail. But let me add that, so when we say 2 out of 3 families are doing better than their parents, 1 out of 3 are not.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Jim, does that answer the question in any way?
Well, I think a lot of studies tend to ignore. I think all too much we characterize as white being wealthy and black being poor, which is unfortunate, because I know of many black families who are middle class and upper class than myself, and I'm a struggling middle class person myself, but you know, I think we need to be wary of statistics, because most certainly with looking at 2,000 families, that doesn't bespeak, you know, well for all races.
Sure.
And you know, I think you're looking at a small minority, as you know, we probably need a long-term study.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Jim, well, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
I appreciate the call, and let's go to Josh, who's calling from St. Louis. Josh, you're on the air.
Hey, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a question about the study in regards to just access to education, and more particular, higher education. I'm a college administrator at a highly recognized, well-reputed university here in the Midwest. And what I notice is, you know, we've looked at the numbers for women in higher education, and, you know, every year you're seeing that the percentage of women compared to men has, you know, they always seem to have a larger numbers. And so I'm curious, can you correlate, you know, access to education correlating with increase in access to, you know, jobs that give you, you know, a certain, I guess, class or financial security? Because in that case, when we're talking about shrinking the gap, is the need to focus on K-12 education, specifically in some of these areas where people are lacking. Because clearly it's working for women, specifically white women. So I'm wondering about your thoughts on that.
Okay, let me put that question to Julia Isaacs. Julia Isaacs, any correlation between income and education in this study?
Well, certainly. People with a college education end up having higher incomes than those without. And also, you're right that women's growth in income is indeed correlated with women entering college in greater numbers. I should mention that It's a team of researchers here at the Brookings Institution that are doing these reports on mobility. And one of my colleagues is going to come out with a report specifically looking at differences in mobility of those with college educations and without. And that will be out in February.
Okay. Let's try to get another call into this segment. Let's go to Jimmy, who's calling from Berkeley, California. Hi, Jimmy. You're on the air.
Well, hello. How are you doing?
Very well, thanks.
Yes, I was surprised nobody mentioned the decline of blue-collar jobs as a major factor in decline in black middle-class participation.
That's probably a good point. I'm not sure it was covered in the study that Julia did. But Julia, what do you say to Jimmy? The decline of blue-collar jobs is contributing to the decline of black income.
No, as you said, we were looking less at the underlying factors. This is a 15-page report and does not go into the many factors such as declines in jobs.
But Jimmy, thanks for that. Thanks for that call. This is a subject we're going to be sort of considering in the rest of the hour a little bit later. So, Julie Isaacs, what's next in terms of sort of the next step in the kind of research that you're doing that's going to sort of flesh out this story?
Well, what I'm working on right now is looking at cross-national comparisons. I think we tend to think that we have more mobility in this country than in many European countries. In fact, the best available evidence suggests that's not the case. Hmm. We actually have less mobility overall, and it's hard to compare across countries, but the evidence certainly suggests we have less mobility from the bottom than in some other countries.
Well, Julia, I want to thank you for joining us today. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
That's Julia Isaacs. She's the Child and Family Policy Fellow at the Brookings Institution and author of the Economic Mobility Studies funded by the Pew Foundation. She joined us from the Brookings Institution here in Washington, D.C. We're talking about the income gap between black families and white families. Up next, Clarence Page joins us. He has an op-ed on this issue in today's paper. You can join the conversation at 800-989-8255 or send us email. The address is talk@npr.org. I'm Anthony Brooks. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Anthony Brooks in Washington. Neil Conan is away. We're talking about the growing income gap between black families and white families. The Pew study released yesterday shows that in 2004, a typical black family had an income that was 58% of a typical white family's. 30 years ago, the average black family's income was 63% of a white family's. You can learn more about the expanding income gap between blacks and whites and read an essay about being black in America at npr.org/talk. We also want to hear from you on this subject, why the difference, and what can be done to change the numbers. 800-989-8255 is the number to call. Our email address is talk@npr.org. Joining us now in Studio 3A is Clarence Page, nationally syndicated columnist with the Chicago Tribune. And thanks for coming in, Clarence. Good to have you.
Good to be here.
Also joining us is Thomas Shapiro. He's director of the Institute on Assets and Social Policy at the Heller School for Social Policy at Brandeis University. He joins us from our member station at WBUR in Boston. Thank you for coming in, Thomas Shapiro.
It's a pleasure.
And let me start with you. What explains this persistent and widening income gap between whites and blacks? I mean, I'm sure there are lots of reasons, historic, social, economic, but what explanation is on top of your list?
Well, at top of my list is what the Pew Report really, its main finding is the inability of African American families to pass along their income achievements to their children. And I'm pretty sure from a lot of work that I and others have done that one of the foundations of this is not only the 58 cents on a dollar income gap, but what I also think really underlies that is a racial wealth gap, where the average African American family has a dime for every dollar of financial assets that the average white family has.
Literally 10%.
Literally 10%. Mm-hmm. And if we did the middle income control on it and just compared African-American middle-income families or middle-class families to white middle-class families, we in fact get a significant rise. It rises all the way from a dime on the dollar to about 25 cents on a dollar. So what we're seeing here is again, the inability of the relative inability of African-Americans to pass along hard-earned and merit-based achievements in schools, in the paychecks and on the jobs to their children.
Hmm. Clarence Page, I want to bring you into this conversation. In your column today, you wrote that, quote, Americans love to talk about race if it means they don't have to talk about class.
That's
this,
right.
This seems sort of pertinent to what we're talking about right now.
Oh, yeah. I'm not the first person to make that observation, by the way. I think I'm happy that more people are beginning to realize our inequity problems today are much more class-based than race-based compared to 40 years ago when your study begins. And this is very pertinent to me because I've not only studied this academically and journalistically, but I've lived it, Anthony. I grew up in a steel town there in southern Ohio back 40 years ago when I was just starting college. That turned out to be, little that I know, but the last great industrial years for America, for the steel mill where I was working, for a lot of other industries in Ohio, which is just economically devastated. Frigidaire, Huffy Bicycle, National Cash Register, I could go on and on. The companies that were real muscle, big muscle money-making companies that where a family from Alabama like mine could come up north and without a high school degree or diploma, you could make a comfortable middle-class income back then. I noticed Julie Isaacs mentioned that inflation-adjusted dollars. She was talking about people with around $56,000 today. I don't know what that was exactly 40 years ago, but it was a fraction of that. I would guess, maybe Tom Shapiro would know, I'm guessing somewhere around 20,000, maybe less. And yet it wasn't hard for my parents. My father was a factory janitor, but it wasn't hard for them to pay my tuition at a state university for 4 years, and for me to, with summer jobs and part time work, take care of the rest of the cost. College affordability is much less these days. Tom Shapiro's right about family wealth. When my parents passed on, my dad had taken the time to buy the house we lived in, plus two rental properties, all three of them put together in that devastated economy in my hometown, added up to about $15,000 total. This is in the late 1980s, early 90s. And we were a more fortunate black family in that regard having those three properties. So you could go on and on in regard to how the economic shifts over the last 40 years have had a big impact on blue-collar families, especially black folks.
It seems like Thomas Shapiro, That Clarence Page is sort of getting back to this issue that you were talking about. You were talking about this accumulation of wealth and how it's more difficult for black families to accumulate wealth and pass it on. Where are the obstacles there, in your view?
Well, the obstacles really come from three sources. Number one is it comes out of that income gap. Very, very simply, average African American family has 58 cents on the dollar. These days, there is less discretionary money at the end of the month, less opportunities to save and invest and be thrifty about. Number two, and probably at least as important, is the long history, the long legacy of race in the United States. And I think in this instance, race is absolutely critical to an understanding that it really is only the present generation of African-American middle-class families that have had an opportunity to create any financial assets or wealth for themselves. That is, those opportunities were largely denied from them systematically in all previous generations. And then third is the way in which wealth is created in American society. Most wealth is created in the form of home equity, the amount of value our homes appreciate over time. Not the money we put under the sofa or put into a bank account or make a shrewd stock market investment. In fact, two-thirds of America's middle-class wealth is in the form of home equity. And we know that there is a segregation tax that operates, that homes appreciate much more rapidly in value when they're in whiter communities. So the same homes in an African-American versus a white community, that home in the African-American community likely is going to increase in value and create wealth, yes, but at the same time, it's going to create less wealth.
And so what do we know about black home ownership in terms of percentages? I mean, do fewer blacks in terms of percentages own their own homes? And so that gets to what you're talking about, right?
Yes, that gap is about, from the top of my head, it's and I think I'm right, it's about 20% less. But it's even more stark than that. because the home ownership gap, white and black, is at its widest at the younger age groups. African Americans actually, as they go through the life course, starts to catch up a little bit more in terms of home ownership. But homes appreciate in value. They create wealth over time. So the longer you've been a homeowner, the more likely it is that your wealth has grown much more greatly.
Mm. We're talking about the income gap between black families and white families with Clarence Page and Thomas Shapiro. You can join the conversation by calling 800-989-8255. Let's go to Jocelyn, who's calling from St. Charles, Illinois. Hi, Jocelyn.
Hello, are you there?
Yep, you're on the air.
Well, you know, from my experience, a lot of what I've heard all of your experts talk about today is true for me. Our family, both my parents were the first in their generation to go to college, and both of them taught school, but none of them really amassed anything. And so when I suddenly lost my father at 17, there was nothing. And so my mom and I went forward and managed. But again, there was never really that sense of passing on from one generation to the next. And so I find myself now being much more aware of teaching my children, number one, all of those things that I wasn't taught. We didn't talk about money. We didn't talk about building assets. And I want to pass that on to my children, but I find myself being really concerned about how that hasn't happened before and what do I do personally to reverse that trend.
Interesting, Jocelyn. Thanks for the call. Clarence Page, what do you hear in Jocelyn's call there?
Well, certainly a widely voiced concern. I will say, you know, in the beginning of the Bush administration, he put a big push on to encourage home ownership and housing and urban development. Made a big push to push more Black and Hispanic home ownership, and the numbers were looking quite good because of the a good economy and low interest rates. In the last couple of years, as you know, subprime mortgage crisis has been devastating for new homeowners of all races. And I'm waiting to see, everybody's waiting to see as this shakes out what the devastation is going to look like at the other end. But let me point out another thing we haven't said much about, and that is the staggering rise in single parenting in the Black community over that last 40 years. In 1965, when Daniel Patrick Moynihan's report came out, he was shocked that a single Black parenting was around 25%, and that was more than twice what the white out-of-wedlock birth rate was. Today, it has soared up to the high 60s, around 67% back in the 90s, where it's been kind of flat. Meanwhile, the white out-of-wedlock birth rate is climbing up to past where it was when that 25% that shocked Moynihan among Blacks in the 60s. Again, this study, Pew study, doesn't go into enough detail for us to really see what the impact of that is. But we do know from other studies, Urban Institute and others over the last few years, there's a lot of disenchantment, disengagement by young Black males. Young Black females are going to college at a much higher rate. So there's a lot of different factors that can account for this slippage.
Let me read an email on this subject, Clarence. Comes from a listener named Hayes. Upward mobility is difficult even in this society, but for single family homes not receiving child support, it's nearly impossible. You need a strong family that can save for a child's education and own their own home so they have an asset that can be borrowed against. This is the recipe for upward mobility. And Thomas Shapiro, I want to sort of come back to you. What policies can turn this around? I've heard you talk in the past about the idea of asset development. How do we do that?
Thank you. Let me just quickly turn to Hayes's question.
Sure.
I think it really starts to capture something that is very important in the Pew report that you have to really read to see it in there. And what in my reading of the Pew report, what they're saying is that a family's total income has in fact increased over the 40 years that they were looking at. While having said that, they also tell us that families are sending more workers into the workforce, and we know from other data that individual workers are working about 100 hours more in 2004 than they did in 1973, so that the rise in family income comes at a cost, and it comes at a pretty high cost, I think, about the squeeze on middle class life that is sending more people into the workforce and having people work longer hours in that workforce. Now, having said that, there are very clear implications when there is only one adult in the family. That is, the opportunities to send more people in the workforce, and if there are children in the family, those opportunities are even less. So the squeeze of making it into the middle class and staying in the middle class is something that has really been pressing much harder over the last 40 years.
Mm. We're talking about the income gap between black families and white families. Joining us is Thomas Shapiro and Clarence Page, and we're taking your calls at 800-989-8255. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go to a caller. Let's go to Meredith, who's calling from Lincolnton, North Carolina. Hi, Meredith. You're on the air.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to share from personal experience that, I come from a white family on the lower side of the middle class income, on the very low side of middle class. And my parents raised three children, all three of us, professionals. Two of us have master's degrees. And, we took individual responsibility for our education, and by that I mean we took out student loans, we paid back our student loans. We didn't blame anybody. We didn't blame the wealthy that we didn't have more money. We didn't blame a race that we didn't have any more money. I feel like there is inherent in this study that there's like a blame for someone that put on the white Americans that the black Americans are not making as much as white Americans. And I feel like it's more of an individual, work ethic, value system. My parents stuck it out together. I think single parenting is very important to look at. There was a work ethic instilled in me by my father, who never made anywhere near middle income. And I grew up with that, and I took it with me to graduate school. I took it with me to this day, to where I am, working hard and trying to make the best life I can for my children, saving for their education. But I'm not going to blame wealthy white America.
Okay, Meredith, I think we got your point. Clarence Page, what do you say to Meredith? Is there room
in
this discussion?
That column I wrote that you quoted earlier, yeah. I make that point that these studies should begin discussion, not end it. these are our studies that say something very valuable about what's happening in America. And I think it's unfortunate that Meredith, is that her name?
Yes.
Read into this blame. Nobody's mentioned the word blame. Nobody's talked about any particular people being responsible for this. That all is what needs to be talked about. There's a great debate going on in the country right now about the gap between blacks and whites and others, and whether it's a question of personal responsibility, whether the government ought to do something about it, whether or not we have a community responsibility. All I know is that with my family, the opportunities I have today weren't open to my dad and his generation. Fortunately, the work ethic's very strong in my family, despite a lot of battering that work ethic took, and a lot of other families that weren't as fortunate as mine. The question is, what do we do now? I mean, many white Americans are defensive whenever you bring up race because they have been blamed for so much.
But I just want to put Meredith's point to you, Thomas Shapiro. I mean, the idea that we are talking about the effect of the past on the present. I mean, there were a lot of government policies along the way that for a long time did help largely white suburban Americans at the expense of urban black America, for example. I mean, can you respond to Meredith in some way in that context?
Sure. I think what's really at stake here, along with what Clarence Page was saying, is for us to figure out a way of starting a conversation, and not framing or phrasing questions in a way that is really meant to end a conversation. And I think the Pew Report is very useful in that regard. And in a moment, if you'll give me the time, I do want to respond directly to to the notion of pitting one group against another.
But Thomas Shiver, can you hold that thought, because we're going to have to take a short break, and we're going to talk more about this when we come back. We're talking about the income gap between black families and white families. With us is Thomas Shapiro, as well as op-ed writer Clarence Page. You can join the conversation by calling 800-989-8255. We'll talk more about the income gap in a moment, plus pilots falling asleep in the cockpit. Are pilots too tired to fly? Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now, we're talking about the growing income disparity between black families and white families. You can find more of the numbers that were released yesterday at our website. It's at npr.org/talk. Our guests this hour are Clarence Page. His column in today's papers is entitled Dogged by an Obsession with Race in the Media. Also, Thomas Shapiro, author of The Hidden Cost of Being African American. He studies income disparities in the United States, Brandeis University outside of Boston. And Thomas Shapiro, before the break, you were about to make a point about a response to a call from Meredith about this report and blame.
Yes, thank you. What one central component about race and mobility that has been missing from a public or private or any conversation about the middle class is exactly what it means to move into the middle class and what it takes to stay there. That is, what is middle class stability like? With Demos, a policy organization in New York, we've developed a comprehensive index that measures how secure or at risk middle class families are. And we're going to release this report in the 28th of the month. It's called By a Thread. And among other things, It shows that about 31%, that is just less than a third, of all families that fall in a middle class definition by income, only that number of families, 31%, are insecure, or are secure rather, along the economic dimensions that we looked at. So there's a squeeze in contemporary American middle class life that affects whites, blacks, Asians, and Latinos. All groups who are aspiring for that American dream in the middle class. Now, having said that, and I want to respond very directly to Meredith's question, the report is not blaming whites for the plight of African Americans. I've read the report very carefully. One kind of self-reads that from conversations like this. It's nothing I don't think I have said, nor is it anything that Clarence Page has said or anything that Julia Isaacs has said earlier. Having said that, however, we also have to be very clear about the trajectory of American history and how that history has played itself out, so that, in fact, the largest wealth creation programs for the current middle class Americans, it started after World War II, the Federal Housing Administration, the GI Bill of Rights, the Veterans Administrations, the development of suburban America, mm-hmm. by law and by custom, systematically excluded people of color. So the largest wealth creation opportunities of the generation that started work right after World War II was essentially denied to large percentages of the American population. Now, I think that's historically honest to talk about. I think we need to talk about that, and we don't need to talk about it in a way that blames one group for the advantages of another. But we have to take it into consideration for the conversation, especially if we keep wrestling with what are the policies that we want to try to address this with.
Mm. If I may add
Clarence Page, please.
Real quick, you look over the last 40 years, the deindustrialization, the shifting and moving of jobs, and look at where the jobs have disappeared and look at where they've moved to or reappeared. If they haven't left the country and moved to South Asia or something, they've moved to the suburbs away from the inner city. They've moved out to rural areas or areas of lower wage, lower benefits, lower for health insurance costs, et cetera. They have moved to places where black folks most likely aren't when it comes to the black folks who were displaced or those jobs left behind. Look at what happened after Sears left the west side of Chicago, just for one example. So, again, not blaming anybody, but these are big structural changes in the economy through which black folks, among others, came out in the short end.
Hmm. Well, let's try to get at least one more call into this conversation. Emeka is calling from Overland Park, Kansas. Are you there, Emeka?
Hello?
Hi there. You're on the air.
Yeah. One of the callers called about personal responsibility and people complaining. In my case is the relationship with the financial institutions that has not evolved anywhere over time, like where you can easily get a loan to buy a car for $20,000 or $30,000, but then you cannot use the same credit score to buy a house, where it is even within your income, as to say you've been paying rent for 4 or 5 years and you have a history to show for it. In my case, we have to go to acquire a foreclosure because property bank needed to give that responsibility to somebody else. And we actually have to leave the town to go get that, where we're now trading the cost of driving back and forth into town for our conscious decision to pay mortgage as opposed to paying rent.
Right. Emeka, it's a great point. And Thomas Shapiro, I think Emeka's talking about this whole notion of asset development and sort of the challenge for him.
He certainly is. Probably more squarely, he's talking about a process of wealth deaccumulation by paying those usurious interest rates and having credit scores becoming very, very problematic. I think part of what is at stake here and why it makes a conversation like this even more difficult than it was during the civil rights era of the mid to late 1960s is that in that era, it was pretty easy to, quote, identify who the perpetrator of racism was, who the perpetrators of discriminations was, because it tended to be individuals, and it tended to be images or icons that we could put up there, and we could hear their voices, see their faces, and respond. Today, it is really not so much at the individual level as it is the discrimination continuing to exist at a non-personal institutional level. And I think we see this very clearly, for example, in the subprime and foreclosure and default crisis in contemporary American society, where it is very difficult to put a finger on individuals who might be responsible for some very, very shoddy practices. But it is, in fact, a practice that's affecting a huge group of people, both black and white. In fact, one study tells us that about 2.2 million homes probably will be foreclosed over the next 5 years if present policy does not change.
Mm. Clarence Page, we're just about out of time, literally just a few seconds left, but important report. I want to give a sort of chance to you to make a final comment.
Well, hope you'll invite me back. Anyway.
Anytime.
Let me just dovetail with what Shapiro said. One of the ironies of recent years is that the big push to get more economical mortgages out to neighborhoods that had been denied by decades of redlining and financial segregation, those are the places being hit hard by the subprime crisis now, because many of the people who were pushing loans to those underserved areas, many of those loans were the kind of usurious loans or balloon loans, et cetera, that we're seeing problems with now. So sometimes something that can start out as a good thing to reduce segregation and help improve black wealth can turn into a bad thing when it comes back to bite you. So these are complicated problems.
Clarence Page, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. And Thomas Shapiro, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
That's Clarence Page, a nationally syndicated columnist with the Chicago Tribune, and Thomas Shapiro, who's director of the Institute of Assets and Social Policy at the Heller School for Social Policy at Brandeis University. He joined us from member station WBUR in Boston. Coming up, are pilots too tired to fly?